So first of all, lovely to see everybody, and we're going to be learning now. We'll be moving through this area, this series called Years of Plenty or Years of Prosperity, which focuses on Prakim Tes, Tes Yud and Yud Aleph in Sefer Melachim, and it's really the focus is trying to understand these more complex years in the year in the life of Shlomo HaMelech, where things are going well. But there's the, it comes with its challenges. So our focus this today is going to be looking at the latter half of Perek Yud, the second half of Perek Yud in Melachim Aleph, and seeing some of the interesting relationships and connections that Shlomo Melech makes during this time. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to screen share. The topic of today right now is called. Is the throne of ivory, and I'm just trying to make sure because it looks like I'm just having a little trouble here with the screen share for a moment. I'm having a little bit of trouble. Can 1 second, sorry. Here we go. I'm going to try this again. I'm sorry. I'm just having a little bit of trouble here. Yeah, I'm 1 second. I'm sorry. I'm just really having trouble seeing. I can see it sharing something, but I can't see what it is that it's sharing. So here we go. Yeah, I can see that it's sharing something, but I can't see it myself, what it's actually sharing. So let me try something else. I'm sorry. Something seems to be not quite right here. Okay. Okay. Here we go. I'm going to try sharing the Word document as well. Seems that Adobe is not working for me right now. Okay. Here we go. I'm sorry. Okay. There we go. So I'm going to do it this way because it's a little easier. So okay. So if there's a problem, please jump in. So we're going to be focusing on our unit today is about the ivory throne. It's going to describe Shlomo Melech's throne, but it's also going to describe some of the other relationships that he has with the people around him. So this picture is a picture on the screen of his actual throne. But to be honest, there are some discrepancies which we'll have to take note of as we go a little further. So what we're going to do is we're going to focus on the two sets of psukim. The first set of psukim are Yud Dalet to Yud Zayin in Perek Yud, and then the next group is from Yud Ches to Chof Hei. Here's how it goes. So we're told the following: Vayhi Mishkal Hazahav Asher Bali Shlomo B'Shana Echas 666 Kikar Zahav. 666 gold is what he's bringing in on an annual basis. Talents of gold. Levad Me'Anshei Torim U'Mischaro Rochlim U'Chol Malchei Ha'Erev. Oh, Pachos Oritz. That's despite all the regular trade. The traffic of traders, and of kings and mingled peoples, meaning to say, besides the regular GDP. Vayas Melech Shlomo Mosayim, Tzinar Zahav Shachut. He made 200 targets of gold, which is beaten gold. Sheshmios Zahav Yalei Tzinar Echos, and it took 600 shekels of gold into one of these tzinar of these targets. Ushlosh Meos Maginim Zahav Shachut, Shloshes Manim Zahav Yale Alamagen Hoechos. And he made 300 shields, golden shields, which were made of this particular type of beaten gold. And Vaidnema Melech Base Yar Halivonon. And he placed them in the forest of Lebanon. He placed them in his palace. Okay, so we hear a little bit about the money coming in. We hear about the national GDP. We hear a little about these decorative, the golden edifices around his palace. So let's take a moment to appreciate these ideas quickly, just in terms of the numbers here for a second. So Sheish Me'ois Shishim Vashesh, 666 talents of gold he's bringing in a year. Where does that money come from? So there's two ways of looking at this. One is closed canon and one is open canon in terms of understanding this. Closed canon is that let's try to find that amount that maybe that's reflective of something which you've already heard. Open canon is no. Well, actually, it could be that this is new money that we're talking about. So Rashi takes the closed canon approach, which means that this must be somewhere else that we're looking. We must be able to find this elsewhere. So Rashi says in the first source, Sheshmos Shishim Vashesh, Chiram Nasan La Me'a Ve'esrim. We know Hiram presented to 120 talents of gold. Umalkas Shavar Me'av Esrim. And we know that the Queen of Sheba brought 120 talents of gold. We know that the trade to Ophir in North Africa on the Arabian Peninsula brought in 400 gold. So Hare Sheish Me'os V'Shishim. So putting that all together brings you to 660. So if I look at the previous gifts of gold, the endowments that Shlomo HaMelech got, it all adds up to 660. He says, Ashisha lo yadati me'ayin. And so Rashi says, and the six extra is, you know what, when you're dealing with that kind of amount of money, a little bit of extra is not too difficult to get. We're within shooting range of that number. So Rashi believes that this reflection over here is a reflection of the original trade that we've already seen happening. This is not new. However, there are other Mefarshim who have more of an open canon of perspective. So as an example, the Abarbanel here says, V'ulay ha'shachare sh'shava malkas shava el arza in source 2. Once the queen of Sheba returns to her country, ka'asher ha'alchu shama aniyos shlomo v'abodov me'avosoy, since she had an endeared relationship with him, ho'ya kola oretz livnehem, trade was now open. That means to say, ad she'evyu b'shana echas schum kol kakadol me'azor b'siba samalka. So people could now come to the country, and people were very happy to trade with them because of this trade alliance between North Africa or the, Arabia and Israel. At this point in time, now this is the amount of gold that was coming in. Now, Babanel seems to suggest the money coming in now is new money. This is money based on the trade relationships that Shlomo HaMelech has created. Just to give you an idea of what this is, one estimate of what it looks like. You know, when we hear these numbers in gold and so on. So basically, what does that translate into? So a talent of gold is roughly 75 pounds. That's a significant amount of money. That's 34.3 kilograms of gold, which is equal to 1094 troy ounces. At the gold price of 1,318.78 per troy ounce. Now again, that changes all the time. So again, this idea, the price changes. A talent of gold in today's value is $1.4 million in today's Solomon received 666 talents of the metal each year. This means the value he got each year was 960 million. So when we talk about this according to this calculation, that is a significant amount of money. Okay, some people feel safe investing in gold because gold is, you know, the gold standard doesn't change that much. Gold does change, but it doesn't fluctuate quite as much as other things in the market. And this is what is being described here. So this is a significant amount of gold which is being brought in. I remember when I was a child, we used to go to a place called Gold Reef City, which is actually it used to be a mine in Johannesburg. Johannesburg used to be called the City of Gold. There's many other places that humans butchered were called cities of gold. But nonetheless, Johannesburg was one of those places in the gold rush. And they had a famous mine there called Gold Reef City. And you could go down in the mines and actually see how they mined the gold. And then at the end, they put out a brick of gold. And they said, anybody who can lift this up, it can take it home. And of course, you know, everybody goes up there and, you know, displays their incredible strength to and shows that they're simply not able to lift it up. Gold is extremely, extremely heavy. So I just remember the experience. So when we talk about this, you know, when we talk about a talent of gold, we talk about a serious, serious amount of gold that was being brought to the coffers and the endowment of Shlomo HaMelech. Okay, so this is just to put things into perspective. What is interesting is those shields and those targets. What in the world are they for? So the truth is they are worth for very little. That's exactly the point. Now, Barbanel says, V'hine, gavar v'gadol asher kolkach, in source 3, she'asa mosayim tzina zahav shachut, he made 300 of these golden tzina, v'shosh me'oz maginim zahav, these types of different types of shields. Lo nira ba'olam davar kazeh, you never seen anything like this. Why? Ki ha'kelim ha'eleh, if you want to make a shield, you make it out of iron. If you want to have a functional shield, you'll make it out of barzel, because barzel is a much harder metal than gold is. Gold is very soft. Gold is often an alloy. It is mixed with other things in order to preserve its hardness. So nobody's making golden shields unless, says Abarbanel, you're making it for decoration. And already here, that kind of sort of points us in the direction that there's a certain degree of opulence over here, which is not necessarily like reflective of a good state of affairs in this respect. Like later on, we're going to see when we get later on to Rehoboam's rule and the downfall of Shlomo Melech's initial kingdom, we'll see that when the kings from the outside come in to loot Yerushalayim, which is not going to be too far in the future, we'll see, interestingly enough, that the first thing they do is they take these golden shields. So these are obviously clearly a sign of opulence and wealth, and they're going to be a very attractive booty or loot for those other nations who look inwards from the outside, which relates to a fascinating gematria. The Chida says in his commentary on Tanachia that if you count up the notion of 666, which is the number of talents of gold that he brought in, that mysterious number, he says it's in the gematria of the word tasur. Tasur literally means to go off the path, to not follow what is correct. Which means to say, he says, Kiboze Ovar al Loyosur Levavoy Shihiro Kesev Azov Hashem Susim, that Shlomo Melech was getting a little too involved in this world. He was amassing all kinds of riches. He was investing in too many relationships. These are the kind of things that the Torah says a king should not do. This. Why? For Loyosur Levavoy, let his heart not sway. So says the Chida Tasur, to sway, is the Gematria 666, and already we've been told this, which is fascinating now, because, you know, if you're to ask Shlomo HaMelech at the time that he was amassing this, by the way, do you know that 666 is the Gematria of Tasur? Of course, that wasn't going to be a lesson that he was going to be learning. It's a lesson learned in retrospect. We, with, you know, our 2020 hindsight, can look back and say, oh, this is what it means, but it's something which a person should possibly have learned to appreciate at the beginning. Okay, so this is the first step we looked at over here. Some of the income that he's getting, national GDP. Now we look at his throne and some further relationships. Here's how it goes. Vayasa Melech. We're looking at Psukim Yorches to Chof Hey, the next section that we're going to be focusing on. Vayasa Melech Kisei Shein Godol. He made a large ivory throne. Vayitzapeu Zahav Mufaz, and he covered with the finest of gold. It was overlaid. Shesh Ma'alos, like you say, it had six steps. For Rosh HaGol, like you say, and it had a round back, or above it was a round area. For Yodos Mizel Mizel, and it had armrests, El Mokom HaShevis, to the place of sitting. Ushlamai Arayos, Omdim Eitzel HaYodos, and there are two lions standing on either side of the arms. As a quick aside, you know, we take it for granted, of course, chairs have backs. What are you talking about? Chairs in those days were benches. You'd sit on something and you would support yourself in your arms, right? The notion of having an armrest, the notion of having a back, is absolute luxury, right? We take it for granted today that a dining room chair doesn't have arms, and what use does it have? In the Chafetz Chaim's house, that his dining room had a bench. That was what it was. And people said, you know, Rebbe, could we get you a back to your chair? And he said he didn't want to overly expend, because he felt that if he was asking more on his expense accounts in this world, then the director would look into his books and work out if he's really pulling in enough sales for the expense account. So just understand things. That wasn't so long ago. The idea of having armrests and a back is a very significant notion. Okay, just to put things into context. And there were 12 lions, each two on each of those six steps. Nothing, there was no throne that looked like this in any of the kingdoms. Everything was gold. They didn't, silver? Ah, silver? That was something of for poorer kingdoms, that they would have silver cutlery. Everything was gold in the house of Shlomo. He had the navy of Tarshish in the sea. Im oniti Chiram, with the navy of Chiram. Achas l'shalosh shalim tovoh ani Tarshish v'naisei zohav v'kesef shenehavim kofim v'tukim. And they're bringing all kinds of things. They're bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, peacocks, all kinds of things. Tukim, right, would be brought into taking. This is the cosmopolitan center of the Mediterranean at this point. He became the greatest of all kings, both in riches and in wisdom. And everybody is searching out Shlomo to hear his wisdom. Everybody's bringing all their gifts and to the king. And armor and spices. Horses, mules, spices, everything they possibly can. And they're paying homage to Shlomo HaMelech. Very, very powerful description over here of Shlomo in his majestic throne. Just as an interesting aside for this is that I just finished reading a book Which was not a great book, but it was called The Disappearing Spoon, about the periodic table of elements and the discovery of all the different elements in the table. Anyways, there are some interesting vignettes in there. And one thing which is fascinating is that kings, generally speaking, would always love to have the most precious materials adorning their houses. So one example, actually pretty recently, in the last 150 years, was that there's a substance that is called aluminium. In America, it was branded as aluminum, but it is called aluminium, and it is so for that was actually a substance which is very plentiful in the crust of the surface of the earth, but it was very hard to actually to separate chemically to separate it. So in the 1800s, it was in fact more precious and more expensive than gold and platinum. It was used at the tables of kings. They would have aluminium. And then what happened was, in the late 1800s, a researcher here in America worked out a way through electrolysis to separate aluminium. Thereby, supply increased, demand dropped, and the prices of obviously aluminium is one of the most inexpensive and most useful metals that we use today. But and he was the one who, by the way, branded it as aluminium because he felt it sounded similar to titanium, right? So it's or platinum. So he thought that it sounded more of the precious metal sounds. But nonetheless, it is interesting. On the top of the Washington Monument in Washington D.C. is actually a co is a small pyramid of aluminium. And the reason it is there is because at the time it was the most expensive metal in the world. So just interesting as an interesting aside. So at clearly at this point and for most of history, gold has been the most expensive metal in history, and this is why you're seeing it even as the basic elements and implements in the house of Shlomo HaMelech. So a lot of things to think about. By the way, just if we come back to the original picture over here, it's important just to realize this picture seems to be somewhat incorrect. At least according to the way that it looked like from the explicit description of Psukim, you'll notice that it sounded like there were lions on the steps, and it seems like we have the whole zoo here in this picture. So that does not seem to be the explicit expression of the pasuk. We do see the roundness behind it. There seems to be this whole menorah behind it, but there are lions on either side and armrest. This is another earlier depiction of it is in this picture over here. So you see the similar kind of thing. This is a little more accurate. Where you see the lions on each of the six steps, one on each side, and the lions on either side of the throne with the armrests and the circular back to the throne as well. So this seems to be it. Now, I doubt that Shlomo HaMelech had a scepter which looked like a cross, but nonetheless, it seems that anachronistically, it's much easier for the church to superimpose that retrospectively. Okay, now, what is the symbolism of this? So the Mefarshim try to dig into this. What is going on over here? Why is it that Shlomo HaMelech has this throne with all these different symbols on it? So the Malbim says perhaps the following: Shneim Asar Arayim, why the 12 lions? Ki Degel Yehuda Yotzrasa Aryeh, because again the flag of Yehuda was the symbol of the lion. The Ramaz Al Yud Beis Avosav Mishlomo Ad Yehuda. Oy mi David ad Yaakov. If you count up the generations, there's 12 generations between Yaakov Avinu and David, or from Yehuda to Shlomo HaMelech. So it's a sort of, so to speak, 12 lions, 12 steps all the way from him to the Sion, to this king over at this point in time. And he says, and by the way, also the Yud Beis Ashratin, there's also 12 tribes. Kumo Shayam Shaboy Omar al Yudbeis Bokar, Upre Shor Mea Small, Ken Kisaradin, Omar al Yudbeis Arayos, Shemim Min HaMerkava, Lichlol Chesed of Mishmar. So we know that there was a mikveh in the Beis HaMikdash, which was called the Yam Shel Shlomo. This huge, huge basin of water, which was supported by 12 golden or bronze cattle. The reason is because the cattle come from the side of the Kisei HaKavod, and the image of the Merkava of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is from the side of Chesed. So similarly, the lion is on the same side of the Merkava, because when he would sit on the throne, he would sit in judgment. So it is to include Chesed in the Mishpat, the Din, that he would be exacting on this throne. Fascinating in terms of the metaphysical aspects of this, yeah. What we've seen is two reasons for the symbol of a lion. One is because it is related to the tribe of Shlomo HaMelech, and one is because it relates to the notion of Chesed in Din, as he sits in judgment. We've seen two notions as to why there's 12. Either 12 because the generations from Yaakov to David or Yehuda to Shlomo, or the 12 tribes. The Barbanel just adds a little bit more in over here. He says, so this throne obviously represented his kingship. So I was around. It was like sort of like the horizons. When you lie back on the grass, it's really good to do from time to time, and just look at the sky. It looks like a huge semicircle, right? Your whole vision is encapsulated by this the semicircle of the sky. So this is to represent, so to speak, the heavens, the horizons. Kilu amar shemina shemayim imlichu, as if, so to speak, the center of all horizons is and the choice of all heavens was Shlomo HaMelech. And it had these two armrests. It should be based on the Torah. And then we know there's two parts of the Torah. So as he rested his arms, when he rests his arms, essentially what he's doing is as he's now sitting in front of the litigants in front of him, he is trying to understand. He's trying to use the two armrests of the Torah, which is Torah Shebech Sav and Torah Shebech Peh, as he exacts judgment. And then he goes on to describe the lions. It refers to the prophets and the leaders of Israel of all the generations. Okay, so there's a third option as to why it's lions. Why were there six steps and 12 lions at the bottom? To remind him of the 12 tribes that he represents. Like it was on the ephod. Fantastic. So as it was on the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, so to speak, in the same way that the Kohen Gadol would have the responsibility of the people, he too would have the responsibility. I do want to just note that in these different explanations we've seen between the Malbim and the Abarbanel, we do see a fascinating idea here. And that is that there is somewhat of a personal element over here, and there's somewhat of a communal element here. Meaning, if you think about it as the 12 Shvatim, the 12 tribes, are represented by the 12 lions on the steps, that's great. So meaning to say, he understands the gravity of his situation because he now represents all of these 12 different arms of the enterprise called Klal Yisrael. However, if it's the 12 generations from Yaakov to David or Yehuda to Shlomo, that sounds a little more personal. That sounds a little more personal in terms of his own journey. Maybe that's why there's two lines at the top and 12 lines at the bottom. There's actually 14 lines. Maybe that's to represent both of those notions. But in the end of the day, it does sound a little more personal. So there's both the personal and the national, which are in tension here in understanding the reflections of what this throne represents. One interesting question that I had, and I was very excited to find this answer, is what happened to the throne? What ended up happening to this throne in the end of the day? So there's an interesting Medrash in Megillas Esther, which actually traces the history of this, and it is worthwhile noting why is it in Megillas Esther. We'll come back to that in a second. So the Medrash is towards the very beginning of all the Medrashim. Esther Rabbah says, Amru, they said, Kevon Shemes Shlomo Ola Shishak Melech Mitzrayim Not Lamehem. We know that when Shlomo Melech passed away, there was a little bit of attrition on the southern border, and Sheshak or Shishak, the king of Egypt, came in and looted Jerusalem and took the throne. The reason he took it was because he felt that, look, his daughter had been married into the kingdom of Shlomo HaMelech, and that was he was owed something, and so therefore he came and took this back. That, you know, all relationships turn sour, unfortunately, in this way. So he took the throne as collateral. So what happened was, is afterwards Zerach, the Ethiopian king, fought Egypt and removed it from Egypt. And Asa, a later king of Yehuda, who's a descendant of Shlomo, reclaimed it from Zerach of Ethiopia. Tana Asa v'Kotana, it is taught, Asa v'Chomachi is Yehuda Yoshua le'olav. And there afterwards, after Asa, for the rest of the duration of the kings of Yehuda, all the kings of Yehuda sat on Shlomo's throne. When Nebuchadnezzar, Nabuchodori Utzor, it was his full name, fought against Israel and removed and exiled the people, then he took the throne with them to Babylonia. And when Babylon was destroyed by its ally, Madai and Persia, and then Madai took it to Madai to Yavon, and from Madai to Greece, and Yavon to Edom, and finally Edom has it. Rabbi Elazar would say, from the times of the Gomorrah, this is in the, you know, this is now much later, this is already in the current, in the current era, Anira Isi Shavara Baromi, I saw, ostensibly in the Vatican, it's broken pieces in the Vatican, which means to say that it had this long history and parts of it still may even have remained. It's obviously a very significant edifice. And It is interesting that why does it relate to the Megillah? So as the footnote over here continues, Nebuchadnezzar Yoshavalov, so the king of Babylon sat on it, Koresh Yoshavalov, Cyrus the Great sat on it. Cyrus was one of the overthrowers of Babel. Achashverosh bo leyeshavalov elonichu. Achashverosh wanted to sit on it, and I said, not you. Omle mi she'eno osoy koz mork ratar. Ba'olam eino yoshavalov. Look, you don't either. They felt that he did not have the bloodline himself. As we know that he married into the bloodline, right? So Vashti was actually his laurel wreath. So they did not allow him to sit on it. That's why it says Amad v'asam mishaloi b'damim. So he made his own one with his own money. Hado dirsiv al kisei malchusoi 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 ksiv. Why does it say al kisei malchusoi? He sat on the throne of his kingdom, and the word malchusoi is spelled without a vav, to show you that it wasn't quite as good as the throne of Shlomo Melech. So what the Midrash seems to be conveying, whether or not we can go to the basement of the Vatican today and find these ruins, what the Midrash is saying is that this represented not simply a nice seat. This represented a edifice which remained for many, many, many years afterwards as a representation of the power of Shlomo HaMelech in the world. Fascinating, fascinating description over here. So there's a lot of interesting longevity which is reflected in this. One or two other just points to note over here when trying to understand this is the notion of Tarshish. We saw that he has in Pasuk Chof Beis, Ki Ani Tarshish LaMelech Bayom. He has a navy of Tarshish with him in the sea, with the fleet of Hiram, and from Tarshish, or from these Ani Tarshish, he would bring all kinds of things. We bring all kinds of pleasantries back to Israel. So the truth be told is, where is this Tarshish? So this is a matter which is debated across Tanakh by the Mefarshim as to where it could be. The Ramalim suggests that it is in fact the city called Kartoga. Anybody know what that is? He quotes the Rav Yosef Kara, who says it's the city of Kartoga, but Safon Africa, in North Africa. That is in fact, just to look at the map over here, that is what we call Carthage. Carthage is a huge Phoenician port which was under immense, it was ultimately, there was great wars between the Greeks and the Romans and Carthage, a lot of interesting history over there. It was a great trade port in northern Africa, was Carthage. So the Malbim just raises an issue, and that is that the main fleet of Shlomo HaMelech, as we know, was stationed in Etzion Gaver or Eilat. Those are on the Red Sea. So the issue is like this, is at this point in time, there's no Suez Canal, right? So there's no way of reaching around from the Red Sea into the Mediterranean Sea. So how is it that if we're talking about the Ani Tarshish, if Tarshish is Carthage, then how is it that he's trading in Carthage when essentially his port of access is mainly on the Red Sea? So he does quote somebody who suggests that maybe there was a mistake made in Tanakh, and he says on this Chalila lanu mizeh adas shenomer b'shekosav d'am divrei Hashem tosh. God forbid that we should say that there's a mistake over here. That's not what's going on. Clearly, you need another solution. So the Malbim himself suggests in the bottom over here on page 3 of our MS, he quotes the truth is quoting Yeshayahu shetarshish he ir tarziz she what's this next word which is spanin. Right, what's spun in? Spain. Okay, like a dumo. In the earlier Spain, Shayorocheres had Sorim Besara. They had the area of the Tyrians, which was the Phoenician port, was in a place called Tarsus. Kumosha Kosovo Chachmea Amim. And so he says, no, when they came to Spain, that's which is called Ushpania, that they found gold, they found silver, and that's why they put up a port over there. Where is this area? So what I was able to find over here refers to an area called Tartessus, which is a area just around the main port city called Cadiz in the south of the Iberian Peninsula. And this, if you go back to our original map, would be the Cadiz is over here on the further left side. So as opposed to being Carthage in the middle of the Mediterranean, we're talking about Cadiz, the Tartessus is on the side of here, and that could be referred to Tarshish. Now, what that does is it still makes it difficult to get from the Red Sea all the way around there. You need to still go around Africa. Right, so but it is still closer to the Atlantic Ocean and for greater trade. Another way of resolving this issue is how is it that Tarshish is involved? Is Tarshish itself could not necessarily, if you look at the Pesukim very carefully, it may not be that there were that were going to Tarshish. It could be that these were Tarshish boats, It could have been this was a Phoenician boat which was lent to Shlomo, or fleet which was lent to Shlomo, as an example, and was going to Africa to get all of this information, all this stuff. Another option is that Shlomo Melech had ports on both seas. He had a port in the south by Eilat, and he had a port on the Mediterranean Sea, as would be most likely, because that's where the main sea access is for Israel even today. Anyways, just food for thought in terms of understanding this. It is interesting about Malbim goes to great lengths in trying to understand how this works. I put in the Jewish Encyclopedia suggestions about Carthage, about Tartessa, Sicilia, as other examples as well. So Tarshish is. It's an important thing because Tarshish is talked about numerous times in Tanakh. We probably know it mostly from Sefer Yonah, which is when the ship set sail to Tarshish. Okay, so anyways, be it as it may. Another interesting point, and this is to close off with the conversation today, is that you'll notice that when we go back to the Psukim, I'm sorry for going up and down a little bit, but the Psukim over here describe how everybody wants to come to Shlomo Melech. Kol ha'aretz mevakshim es p'nei Shlomo. Everybody wants to go to Shlomo, and the previous pasuk says because he has all of this osher and chochma, because of all his riches and wisdom. So what do you think they were coming for? Which of those two factors were the reason why they wanted to find Shlomo Melech? So there's an interesting debate which is recorded over here in the Sefer called Gan Na'ul, which is Natali Hertz Videl, living in the 1700s, who suggests, he says, look, he quotes the Abarbanel at the end. At the end, he says, Rav Yitzchak Abarbanel, on the third last line, Zeche Tzadik Livracha, Shama B'Virusho Shodiakos Shechochmo Sivivo L'Shlomo Ha'osher, that the wisdom brought about his riches, Chalila Chalila. That's not the way it works. Shlomo Tzarech L'Kabel Matanos. It's what Shlomo Melech did not need those gifts. He already had all of this gold and silver. So essentially, what the Gana'ul is debating is why is it, where is it that he's getting all of this money from? Is it because of his wisdom that people are coming to hear it? Is it because of the riches that people are coming to visit him? Why are they bringing these presents? Are these simply homage, or this actually is a source of income? And this is a debate. He believes that ultimately, that the way he says, and the lesson that he learns is Lelamdenu, we should learn, Ki Asher, Ki Asher Adam Yireh Es Hashem. The person who praises Hashem is praiseworthy. If you fear Hashem, you will have the Spirit of God. And you'll bring them closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In other words, what the real currency over here is, says the Gan Na'ul, is wisdom and closeness to Hashem. The riches happen to be extraneous to this. The Abarbanel says, looking at it from the perspective of a statesman, Abarbanel was the second most important Jew in all of Spain. He was on the government of both Portugal and Spain, and later on moved off to Vienna. He was a very, very perhaps one of the most powerful Jews who ever lived in the diaspora communities. Is well aware of the flows of money and wisdom. He had both. And so what Abarbanel says, on a more realistic perspective, we're looking at it from this perspective. Yes, it's true that Shlomo Melech had great wisdom and fear of Hashem, but that also allowed Shlomo Melech to be incredibly wealthy because of the places he decided to invest in, and because of the influence that it garnered him when governing the world. Anyways, so this is food for thought. This closes off this section. What it leaves for us now is, God willing, next time when we rejoin in 2 weeks' time, what we're going to do is we're going to start focusing on some of the slipping points of Shlomo Melech. We're going to see his stables and how much opulence seems to invest there, his relationships which seem to go out of hand, and we'll see some of the, unfortunately, the slipping points of Shlomo Melech. This closes today's session in the meantime.